This week's episode of The Rebooted Show is brought to you by Beehive, the platform trusted by enterprise publishers like Newsweek and Time. Newsweek is in the midst of an exciting transformation. With AI disrupting search traffic, they're building direct relationships with their audience through newsletters. Bharat Kharish, Newsweek's chief product officer, spoke about why they chose Beehive. And he said that Beehive's consumer-first, tech-driven DNA was exactly what they were looking for. That B2C background ended up growing their tool into being enterprise ready. Newsweek has aggressive newsletter plans designed around adding new audiences and launching new products. With more industry leaders like Newsweek migrating to Beehive and 2026 planning in full effect, now's the time to see how Beehive can take your content to the next level. If you want to see what your next stage of growth could look like, go to beehive.com/TRB. That is spelled BEEHIIV.com/TRB. And meet with Beehive's team of growth and newsletter experts today. Thank you so much to Beehive for their support. Welcome to The Rebooting Show. I am Brian Morrissey. I'm joined this week by Darren Cross. Darren is a longtime digital entertainment executive. He is the author of Nobody Planned This, How Platforms Rewired Entertainment. Darren ran strategy at Maker Studios. If you don't remember Maker, Maker was one of the original, really, MCNs.
It was the biggest.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, and the MCN was an interesting period of time. And I think I want to spin this forward into what's going on in the creator economy, because I know, Darren, you have an interesting viewpoint on that. So welcome. Glad you take the time.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. So walk us through a little bit. Like, I mean, so you ran strategy at Maker. I think at the time it had like 80,000 creators on the network. Now, the creator economy at the time, I don't even think it was called the creator economy. Was it?
No, that is actually a phrase that's evolved since, right? It kind of, and I don't mean this negatively, but it kind of elevates the profession a bit, right? Creator has a very, very nice tone to it, right? Biblical even. But yeah, it wasn't as big. And in certain ways, that was a virtue.
In what ways?
It allowed more native niche content. It allowed more personality. It's back when the label authentic really meant more authentic. It really was more personality driven. It really was exploring more, less mainstream themes than current creator economy does. Less replication, less copying than you see now in the influencer
creator
space.
It was less optimized, I think. Right.
It's like, I think of it like music, right? I think of it like before Chuck Berry, there wasn't a Chuck Berry. So Chuck Berry got to be Chuck Berry, right? And before punk rock and before rap, a lot of these musics, they had to find an access where they could compete because they didn't have all the things that the previous access had, like resources and super skilled players and all that. You get in a different weapons race where it's more about ideas and difference and cultural relevance.
Yeah. And this is as, I mean, really, YouTube. Let's like zero it in on YouTube, right? Yeah, like, so, yeah. You know, YouTube now it's like TV. It's now like a meme to say YouTube is now TV.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, YouTube was much smaller. I remember, you know, as a reporter writing about YouTube in its earliest days, and it was like a thrilling thing. And there were these people who were developing. They were messing around on YouTube. It did have a feel. It was kind of exciting. There was Rhett and Link, and there was, you know, iJustine.
Smosh.
I remember.
There was a bunch.
Smosh.
Yeah.
I did. Mm-hmm. I would do like roundups, like the YouTubers you need to know, like for brands and marketers. And it would Michelle Pham, the makeup, the early
absolutely.
Sort of makeup
Ipsy.
Person. Yeah. I don't know. So, you know, there was like, it was definitely a different era. And I feel like just as the platforms got bigger, you know, this field changed a lot. So what is the current state of the sort of creator economy centered on YouTube?
Well, I mean, that's a big question. So in the old system, traditional media, the locus of power was with the studios, right? Because they had scarcity always drives things. Scarcity determines power. In my mind. So the studios had scarcity. So they were the funds, they were the source of talent, they were the facilities. So they really, with that, they earned the role of gatekeeper. And they also became the entity who placed the bets on what would be would hit in mainstream culture, right? And that was a very youthful model right up through MASH, I think, right? But beyond that, cable started to fray that a bit, but the creator economy frays it more, where the locus of power really comes to the, it's not really purely distribution, but it's like distribution, it's the platforms.
Right.
So the platforms have a different idea. They're not gating for letting only a few select people in and placing big bets on them. They're letting everybody in, placing no bets on them, and then optimizing, iteratively.
Right.
So
yeah, and that changes things
wins.
Completely. You know, and that's why the platforms love creators.
They do to a degree.
I mean, I love the notion of creators, because who wants to negotiate with a couple of people when you've got like millions, like nobody has leverage.
Bingo, right? To a certain degree, watch time is watch time. Now, we can debate what quality entertainment gets what premium for advert inventory, but basically, they'd rather not negotiate with millions of creators and have the outliers show up regularly, like they do, as opposed to negotiating with 100 Mr. Beasts across 25 different genres, right? Because they don't need to be having competitors bid for their time, for their attention, for exclusivity. They like the disproportionate bargaining power implicitly.
And the way the sort of creator, I mean, there's obviously millions of creators, right?
Oh, yeah.
But it's developed into like being a power wall, law, like to a large extent, right?
Oh, yeah. And it is a wall, right? I mean, so it used to be talent and being early or being brave was a differentiator 10 years ago or so. And it still is to a certain degree, but now there's more brute force, right? So when somebody like Mr. Beats reaches his scale, he has a lot of more momentum behind him. He has investors. He has a team. He has the ability to make, I'm not saying he's making subpar content, but he can make a lot of content that doesn't have to be a hit, because it's going to be a hit, because it's going to be in storefronts around the world, and somebody's going to walk by and gawk at it long enough to drive an ad impression.
Right. And once you have that distribution, you know, you can make a lot of mistakes, basically. You can go a lot of different directions. You have optionality. And Mr. Beast is building an entertainment company. Like, I'm not sure. Like, it's a different type of entertainment company, because it has a quote-unquote creator at the front of it. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it starts to look a lot like a regular entertainment company, right?
Yeah, it is. Like, it's a bit of cosplay, right? He's a creator. But he's kind of, he was a creator. He's still a creator, but he's really an organization now. Mr. Beast is an organization, and Mr. Beast is a brand, right? So he's not coming at it in the old fashioned way where established artist star would then create something like their own, you know, Desilu, right? He's coming from the other way, where he came up from nothing, reverse engineering how YouTube rewarded creators, doing things like, you know, counting to 100 and underwater and, you know, all the things he did early on were just very, very simple, but they were riveting in their own way. And he's built from that. So he's come from a creator background to a place that's really, he does television better than television in many ways now.
Well, he did the Super Bowl ad for Salesforce. I'm not saying it was one of the best ads I've ever seen, but I don't think I'm like in the Jimmy Donaldson audience target. So
yeah.
I don't know, but then again, I'm not sure Salesforce, I have no idea why it made sense for Salesforce to have Mr. Beast, who's like, I guess his core constituency is children. I don't know, maybe children are using B2B software. I don't know.
Everyone needs a CRM. It could be, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's not as bad as it was when I was at Maker, but there's still a little bit of my son knows this creator. They're big.
Yeah.
In the suite that makes these big money decisions for advertising, right? They're not natives. They're visitors to this land.
Right. But like, it seems like the middle class did not develop and won't necessarily develop. Is that fair?
That's my thesis, right? I mean, in the same way that there's no real middle class in traditional entertainment, right? It's just not necessary for the most part, especially in front of the camera, right? So what YouTube wants and needs is they need a few bright and shiny tent poles. That's Mr. Beast. And then they need an endless flow of content, which up till now has been provided for free, mostly, by millions of creators around the world. And they just wait and see what pops and then pushes it. So they really become an optimization engine around routing, right? That's their play. And that works. But ultimately, they don't they don't not care if there's a bunch of stars. I mean, they kind of, in a perfect world, they kind of like fungibility. And at a certain level, it does become a little bit of a price differentiator as a human. So they are kind of heading towards Spotify, which has a lot of AI-driven stuff that pays no one, right? But until then, they don't really need to because there's so many creators creating quality content for free. So, I mean, ultimately, it is a differentiator, but we're not to that point yet for video.
Yeah. I was just talking about this AI-generated account out of India that has billions of views.
Yeah.
I mean, and it costs like $60 to produce these videos. It's like an AI monkey that's in various situations. Great business.
Well, that's the irony, right? That's the irony. Okay. Because India, up until very recently, was the low-cost production locus for people.
Yeah.
Which, I go back 20 years. I was at Clickstar, which is an Intel-funded venture with Morgan Freeman. And this is when encoding was like a black art. And it was done literally in Burbank. And you paid a lot to get video content encoded.
Yeah.
But very shortly, it became something that was price competitive, done for pennies in a place far, far away. And now you don't even need to move it to a place far, far away. It's just a machine that does it. So there's really no human advantage by putting it in India anymore, really. It's just a...
Yeah. I mean, this account is Bandar Apna Dost. It has 3.13 million subscribers. All AI created.
We've probably all seen some.
So is that like sort of where these platforms will end up going? Because I think the question I have as inevitably 99% of content is going to be synthetic. And the weight, usually the, you know, trying to separate what's human from what is AI. First of all, it's like, is that spam? Not necessarily. People obviously really like this AI monkey from Bandar Apna Dost. And, you know, so I don't think necessarily the platforms are going to just say AI content bad, human content good. You see, you know, like on Spotify, like, yeah, I don't know, to go to sleep, there's lots of different things you can do with AI. Like, I don't necessarily think I think it should just probably be on the quality of the content as judged by the audience. But is that the sort of direction that you see these platforms, and particularly YouTube, going? And then how are they going to deal with the inevitable flood of limitless AI content? Or does it not matter?
Yes. Well, yes, but let me qualify a little bit. First of all, I don't think 99% is probably the number. It's going to be a lot, but I don't know what the number is. But so right now, we've got a very rich competitive floor for content creation that's all human, for the most part, on video, right? It's been very effective at keeping the incremental cost of a new video pretty much at zero. But eventually, AI will set the new floor for cost, right? And it's also very quick to pick up trends and emulate, which YouTube, as it's matured, has become more of, where it's an emulation factory, right? So a format hits, and all of a sudden, everybody's doing it. So YouTube is already moving that way because they've seen the success of TikTok and Instagram at making creators' personality and less important. They don't have followings as much, right? The fungibility of creators is more prominent on those platforms, and it certainly is more prominent on YouTube with YouTube Shorts. So they have no, if they're not longing for it, they at least have no aversion to it, right? So going forward, there'll be more of that, and you start to weave AI-generated content into the mix, much the way you see on Spotify. And if you're just somebody who wants something easy listening that sounds like Kenny G, you can get 2 hours of it, and maybe some of it is Kenny G, some of it's people, some of it's just AI riffing on smooth jazz, right? Who knows? But so that is a future. But at the same time, I mean, I see this in my son and other kids. I had this conversation with a colleague the other day. My son has a visceral reaction to AI. We went to see Avatar. I kind of pushed to see it. And it was really kind of funny because it's a long film, right? And you're sitting in the theater, after a while, the scenes that are filmed like in the lab where it's really people and less AI generated stuff feel jarring. Like they're two different worlds. Really, you know what I mean? It doesn't feel the same. And I felt discomfort. And my son started talking about it afterwards, how much AI was there and how much is it AI. And well, it's AI, it's machines. And we went through this discussion, but he has a visceral AI reaction where he connotes some AI, a lot of AI content, similar to the way he jibes at Facebook content. It's for the olds, right? is for
what AI content is for old people.
A lot of it, because he thinks that he pejoratively talks about AI content as the stuff that old people mistakenly share because they think it's real.
Oh, well, that's reassuring then.
Yeah, and it is nice, right? And I was saying this to another friend, a former colleague at Maker, and he talked about his 19-year-old son. He said, yeah, it's really funny because just last week, my son, who's been a longtime Orange Fanta drinker, came to me and said, Dad, from now on, buy Orange Crush. And he's like, why? He goes, that Coca-Cola AI commercial.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a pretty strong reaction, right? And I, in my mind, I line that up with the resurgence of the adoption and interest in formalized religion in younger generations in the United States the last 4 or 5 years. There's a need to belong, inclusiveness, especially younger people where content is identity, right? There's a lot of things tied up in that. So I think those pockets remain. That's why I think niches and genres will still matter. And that's where AI is weakest. Then ironically, I also think for traditional media, there's a lot of rights. There's a lot of stuff that people riff off of, right? So those things, in a weird way, will become even more valuable because you're going to want to secure those rights to not get sued for the things you're riffing on with AI.
So what does YouTube look like then in like 3 years? Is it that different or is it, you know, fairly similar?
Dynamics? I think my gut is it feels a lot like now. It's just you have less certainty about how something's made and by who.
Right.
Right. Was it really a creator or was it a company? Was it a company using a real person or was it AI? I mean, there's a bunch of different breadcrumbs along the way to figure out.
I mean, I assume that
consuming.
They will label it, right? Like, I mean, if look, I think
if they have to,
have to is interesting. Like, I mean, because it's either they have to because of the market or they have to because of the government or regulations of some kind, right? Like,
I think it'll be both.
Yeah, I think I can see pressure and they've been down this road before, uh-huh. Right? Like they would not have an advertising business if they did not figure out how to find copyrighted music and if they weren't able to find nipples. Like, I mean, nothing concentrates the mind and they were able to do that. That's why anytime these companies say, oh, it would be impossible for us, I'm like, well, gee, when you had like, you know, billions on the line, you were able to figure out, you know, the nipple technology. So don't tell me you can't figure this out because if enough money.
I talk about this in my book.
Where they're like with AI, it's like, we can't figure out where the content came from. I'm like, trust me, you can figure this out.
There's a structural schizophrenia with the platforms. It's a split personality that's kind of intentional. Because they will, if you're an advertiser, they will tell you in great granularity and great confidence how they know your audience and how they can target your audience and how valuable that audience is. So they have great, great knowledge on behavior and activity and all this kind of exhaust trail that every user leaves when they watch. But if you go back to them and say, like, you know, how many of those audience members do you think are 12 or 9? And they're like, we have no way of knowing. How could we possibly know? and that's not true, but they're not going to stand in front of that on inference, even if they could, because it's a lot of liability on inference. But also, it kind of craters our business. And that's going back to your question about where YouTube looks like in 3 years. YouTube has morphed quite a bit over 10 years. When I said it was freer and more adventurous, more experimental 10 years ago, that's partly because of the audience. The audience was young, and they were along for that ride. Now, the audience now, on average, is much older when you aggregate them all. And they're watching on oftentimes a communal device and not a individual device. So those two dynamics make it very different kind of content that's coming out of it. And then when you raise the stakes that all the money's being put into this by brands and private equity and everybody else, all the decisions matter way more than they did when PewDiePie was posting his first 100 videos.
Yeah. And so what determines now, like whether something takes off on YouTube? Is it almost like too late to establish? Because we always see people come too late to like every party, right? And like there were so many advantages to having built an audience and having that distribution early on with YouTube. Is it still, and I still see people like, there's like, oh, now we're going big into our YouTube strategy. Is it still practical to be able to build like a really strong YouTube channel starting now?
For a big company that wants to develop IP and produce content in a traditional way, I think that's a real tough bite to take, right? But I mean, the other side of this coin is that it's always been this way. To get into music, to get into sports, there's a certain part of society that's young and ambitious and without resources that takes a swing, right? And the luxury here is you get millions of swings. So somebody's voice is going to stand out. So it's really an incredible experimentation layer at the bottom of the creator economy, as it is with any medium, like with punk rock or rap music. It was not being driven by labels. It was not being driven by the audience even. It was somebody had a voice, couldn't see their way through the current system, and had to find an audience a different way. And that's a lot of what YouTube is. And someone will. I don't know who. I don't know how. But something.
But when you talk about punk rock, like, I mean, that runs completely counter to YouTube being so mass and being where old people are. Like, we're seeing new kinds of, I don't even know if these are creators or influencers. Yeah. I have to bring up the clavicular guy. Like, I wish I didn't know clavicular, but like, I do know clavicular.
Yes.
But like, no, but streaming like has become Kai Cenat, and like streaming. Like, it's slightly different. Like, I think, I don't know, I think about it as slightly different than YouTube.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe this is peculiar to me, but I abstract back. So when I think about the music business, I think about selling records. And they're selling records to all kinds of people. So if you're an up-and-coming 18-year-old who has some musical talent, maybe you don't have access to formalized musical education. But you've got taste. You've got some native talent. So you don't have the hours or the resources to learn how to play the guitar at the level of Jeff Beck. But you know what? If you could sample and you can narrate and you can find a new medium to express yourself, you don't need those skills. You need a different set of skills. So you change the access on what competition and what good means, right? And that's what YouTube did originally. They changed the access of what quality was. It was no longer production quality and writing and lighting and everything else. It was a metric that was more kind of hard to put your finger on of authenticity, which when that word really still meant something in the creator space.
And so that is like fading, right? Like is the authenticity bit fade? And because you start to me, the middle is always meat, right? Like, I mean, we saw during the pandemic, like, you know, production quality go down on like broadcast. They were like just doing Zooms. And I was like, oh, we can do video now if it's Zoom. Yeah. But then, you know, you look at what a lot of YouTubers are putting a lot of money into production. I mean, like, it's not like they're the selfie stick people anymore.
No.
I mean, it can be. It depends on the content. But, like, that doesn't seem like much of a differentiator.
Agreed. Here's what I would say about that. So, yes, for those people that are at that level now, they are very much television, right? And you'll see that they're distributing their content to numerous places. Netflix and Amazon, and you know, they're basically television. I mean, Mr. Beast has transcended YouTube, but there are still tons of YouTubers, and what will come next, new formats, new genres, new expression, will not come from people emulating Mr. Beast, right?
Yeah.
It's much bigger, so it's harder to find this needle in the haystack, but the beauty of it is it will show up as it starts to get trends. And those trends are different than they were 10 years ago because YouTube is so much more international than it was 10 years ago. But maybe I'm naive, but I believe they will surface. And that is one of the virtues of YouTube, is this vast R&D, this vast experimental layer, that it's low cost, low friction to get it up. And then if it somehow catches fire in the algorithm, then that becomes... Once it becomes a hit, then everybody does it, right? I mean, and that's both a blessing and a curse for the space. But if a trend takes off, I mean, what Mr. Beast does now, or what he did 5 years ago, wasn't what YouTubers did 5 years before that.
Right.
So there will be an evolution, and something will work, something will change, and it could be a very small tweak. I mean, honestly, some of the stuff that Mr. Beast did early on was kind of cringy for me. Some of his stuff was like, you know, like the Ed McMahon giveaway type stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, oh.
Well, you know? I find Mr. Beast a very difficult character. Maybe it's me as like a middle-aged guy, but like, I don't find it really like an inspiring story. Like, I don't like, I mean, he's like, it's all this optimization and all of these like, these weird stunts, and the stunts have to get bigger. And I'm not sure what exactly the value is of any of this stuff. And now I'm really sounding old. I personally, it doesn't like appeal to me. Yeah. I'm like shocked that this person is that successful. And I think it's just the, you know, I think it was when I saw like what he does with the thumbnails. And I think one of my struggles with YouTube is how over-optimized it is. Mm-hmm. And I think about what people are doing with open claw and all this agentic AI. And I'm like, oh yeah, Mr. Beast was like testing like 1,000 thumbnail variations. Everyone's going to be testing 10,000. The agents are going to be doing that overnight and they're going to be auto optimizing. And it feels like it's going. And Mr. Beast has always had a little bit of dystopian vibes to me. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
There's a, I mean,
something I can't put my finger on there, but like, you know, his success feels overly engineered.
Well said. So here's what I'll be honest. He's not for me, right? Okay. He's not my kind of stuff. But you know,
that said,
99% of cable television wasn't for me.
That's
right?
True.
So, I mean, I have never seen Real Housewives of anything. I don't know. I can't even name all the cities that CSI belongs to, right? I don't know. Don't care. It's not me. Yeah, and Mr. Beast does have this weird Stepford Wife kind of vacancy in his eyes when he's on screen, for me, at least. It does seem super manufactured. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he was actually just AI generated.
He talked about he's like, I don't like to go to like expensive, you know, have expensive meals, like a $20,000 golden pizza. Yeah. I'm like, do you think that that's like, like you a really good restaurant? Some viral food?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's all he's, remember who he speak. Remember who he's speaking to.
I was like, I don't think he's like failing my CAPTCHA test.
Well, you know, mentioning the French Laundry is not going to resonate with 9-year-olds. So you got to speak to your audience, right?
Okay, that's fair.
Especially if they live in Bangalore, right? So you got to keep the references. He's like he's similar to big action movies for Hollywood, right? Keep the plot simple, keep the dialogue simple, and make it lots of, you know, pyrotechnics and nothing will go well around the world, right?
But we're not going to have like an array of Mr. Beasts.
I think you're going to have always that layer because it used to be when you were able to afford a team like Mr. Beast did, first he got discipline and he took it really serious like a business, which differentiated him from a lot of creators. But Markiplier and PewDiePie and a lot of others did that too. But then he started to build a real team, like a business. And what I do admire about him is he spends like every dollar making the next thing. You know what I mean? He's not buying a yacht for himself. He's about like, I want to up it. So what I admire is his ambition, right? And I may not like what he makes, but I do respect the game, right? So there'll be more of that because now with AI and all this, this is kind of going back to my argument about different genres of music because it used to be really hard to make an album if you were like in the 1960s. You had to get resources, or 70s, even 80s, you had to get resources behind you. You had to convince somebody to bet on you so you could have access to a real studio and then you could get the distribution channels and the marketing money and blah, 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 blah. You don't need that anymore. You can make music in your bedroom with really high-end tools and become as big a hit as any of that. And that is coming, is already here with video to a certain degree, but it's coming even more with AI. So what it does is it raises the bar for what the middle tier is, what the middle class has to do. So if a prior middle class YouTuber, the few that there are, was going to say, well, you know, now I'm going to level up by getting myself a team for production, for back office, for marketing, da 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 da. Now, a lot of that can be done with tools that are cheap, AI, like all those thumbnails you just discussed. So what's the next level that require people? That's expensive. And that's where that layer of Mr. Beast type creators can afford, and they keep elevating themselves above the rest. And that's why there's an ever-growing yawning gap between the very top and the huge bottom. It's not a pyramid, it's a spire. It looks a lot like traditional entertainment back when Tom Cruise was at the height of his powers.
Right. You mentioned like PewDiePie. Is he like in like semi-retirement in Japan now? Do I have that right?
I believe that's the case. I mean, he had some...
This is like a young man's game. Like, I mean, he's like a retired YouTuber.
Well, I mean, part of the problem with, especially with PewDiePie, because and earlier YouTubers, a lot of it indexed more towards personality, right? And influencers have this problem a lot too. So, because you can't...
He's got a big controversy section, that's for sure.
Yeah, he does. Wikipedia. We made some mistakes. We made some big mistakes.
If you're an early YouTuber, your controversy section is going to be big.
You know, and let's be honest, these guys aren't trained professionally the way traditional media people are, with coaches and PR people that help them avoid landmines. They're on their own. So they make mistakes. And he's a young guy. And I'm not here to defend him. He's done some weird stuff. But when you're that leveraged to personality, it's hard to keep reinventing yourself, right? When a big part of your attraction is that you are novel, you are new, and you're different. And then the next, and generations now are not as long as they used to be. I don't care what traditional you know, studies say, for me now, a generation is like 5 or 6 years because everything seems to flip within half a decade.
Yeah, it just seems like, I mean, like, for those that can, like, get to Mr. Beast level, and obviously there's very few of them, they can hire teams and whatnot, like, keeping up the pace as, like, a creator. And then, you know, I remember I would always, like, roll my eyes at, like, creator burnout. And I'm like, that's, like, real. Like, to be able to always be on like that is, it's different than the analog entertainment world, I feel like. And having that kind of staying power when things come and go is difficult for creators.
Yeah. Even the feedback cycle is super, it wears on people. It's super hard to carry that burden. It used to be in the old media, you release a movie on Friday and you find out numbers on Monday, right? So production logic was you place bets, put a lot of effort into it, and then it would hit the market and the market would tell you the truth, right? It took time. But for platform logic, you're constantly iterating, creating, evolving in front of the public. And you're doing that with constant feedback. And it used to be on YouTube 10 years ago, you had a dashboard and you watched it maybe daily, right? But with TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube Shorts and all these platforms, they've amped up all that granular data analysis into a very fast loop. So it's almost instantaneously. So you're constantly, it's like you're getting your box office every few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And psychically, that's a huge toll.
Yeah, for sure. And do you see any other platforms emerging to even compete with YouTube, like for the power as like creators? Like it seems like, you know, YouTube has grown so massive as like an ecosystem, mm-hmm, that it's achieved some kind of like escape velocity.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really good at predicting the future. I'm kind of good at kind of reading where things are going. There will be another platform. I don't know what it is.
No, I mean, like right now, do you see like anything? Like, I mean, if you're, mm-hmm, do you see creators no longer just using YouTube as a default? And that's why I asked about like other like streaming platforms, like live streaming platforms.
You mean outside of TikTok and Instagram?
Well, yeah. I mean, like for the type of YouTube content, like it seems like YouTube has, yeah, I don't want to say monopolized the market, but it doesn't have a lot of competition. Like all roads lead to YouTube.
Right now, that's true, right? So what it used to be called 10 years ago or so, they used to call what YouTube produced, these 8 and 10 minute things, they called it short form. Well, now that's not short form. That's long form in many ways, right? Short form is the 1 to 2 minute things, and TikTok dominates that. My son's 13, as I mentioned before, and his main go-to is TikTok. And to be honest, it's not so much for the content, it's for, I don't want to use the community so much. It's the comments. So if I'm driving him to school, I'll hear the same loop of music from the same video for 10 minutes because he is rabbit holing down that comment thread.
Oh, okay.
He's reading it. He's commenting on it. So, and he does that all the time. And he's not alone. His friends do as well. So TikTok is super powerful for the audience. And I think in many ways, YouTube has had to counter that with Shorts. And part of that is mercenary on their part because that accelerates the fungibility trend that they'd like to encourage anyway. The part of it was existential because they're competing against Instagram and TikTok, who've really elevated short form content to an art where it's very monetizable for them. It doesn't really monetize as well for the creators involved, but it does really monetize well for Meta and TikTok's owners. So YouTube is in that game, but what comes next? I don't know. I have this hunch, I have this hope, I have this bet that more real, more belonging finds its way somewhere. Twitch has a very fervent following of real-time kind of relationship building, right? Their audience is very much, they're the closest thing right now that still exists that reminds me of what YouTube was in the early 2010s. I remember going to my first VidCon in 2000, I think it was 11 or 12, and it was literally like a get-together of friends, and fans would walk up to big creators for that day and talk to them like they just bumped into them at the lockers at high school. And there was no pedestal. And what was nice is that the creators talked back to them like there was no condescension, either real or imagined. It was very organic and it felt really cool. And that lasted until about the mid-2010s. And I've been to most of the big cons, including almost all but one of them since COVID. And that vibe isn't there. It was very much not there the 1 year that TikTok took over.
Mm-hmm. It was the main
sponsor.
But
you see, you mentioned like a counter reaction to that, and I think that's interesting. I mean, because again, you said something more real, and I think that is what gives me pause of where YouTube has gone, is it's become so optimized that it feels fake. And I think a lot of things in culture are so optimized to feel fake. Mm-hmm. Like fights feel fake. A lot of the interactions online feel fake, whether they are or not. Yeah. You know, the dramas of like, you know, right-wing podcasters, fake. Like, yeah. You know, a lot of stuff just feels fake.
Yeah.
And I feel like there, yes, and there will be some kind of counter reaction to that.
Yeah, I think I'm a big believer in reversion to the mean. So I think that in and of itself implies that. But I think there's a hunger for that. I mean, while going back to MASH and Lucy, the reason that those things are mass phenomenons is because you only had like three choices, right? It's not that people didn't have their own little niche preferences and interests back in 1957 or 1982.
Yeah.
It's just that they were really hard to get to. I mean, being a person who really loved music that wasn't mainstream, it took a lot of work and a lot of experimentation, and half the stuff I bought, I didn't like because I couldn't just hear it. You know what I mean? I had to go take a risk on it and get rid of it. So this now, at this phase, we have a lot easier low-cost experimentation.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of opportunity. I mean, even on the platforms, even within YouTube, what I'm, if not advocating, at least seeing or hoping for, I don't know what I want to qualify it as, it has roots already, right? I mean, like the Sorry Girls is an example I like to talk about, and where they've really definitely consciously chosen to serve their community as opposed to monetizing every opportunity available to them.
Yeah. It's funny how it just made me think about, you know, online video pre-YouTube, because we think of YouTube as like forever, but you know, the world existed before YouTube, and online video existed before YouTube. It was called like webisodes, and
yes,
it would be on like AOL and Yahoo and MSN.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, because everyone just uses the mental models of the past, and they put it on really fast changing new environments, it was always this idea of like, there needs to be an I Love Lucy moment. It's like, what will be the I Love Lucy moment of online video? And the idea was that it would have to like break through and have like a major moment with a hit that everyone knew, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the way things have developed has been completely contrary to that. You know, and it's not like Mr. Beast is a massive, massive star. I've never seen one full video, but most like, I mean, and it's like never before have so many people been so famous that nobody has heard of. You know what I mean? Like, because we've just become so, it's everything becomes niches.
Well, nobody, if you say nobody's heard of, you mean like our age group.
That's what I mean. What I mean is like, you know what I mean? Like, you know.
Yeah, I do. I do exactly what you mean.
We have a monoculture. Everyone knew about MASH, like what you're saying. Like, you know.
Yes.
And now, I remember our mutual friend Jason Krebs got really mad at me for not knowing PewDiePie so long ago. I was like, what? You got really sensitive about it. He's claiming that he never gets mad.
Well,
Jason,
you know, fun fact, that 19-year-old I mentioned earlier belongs to Jason. So that's a real life story. So, you know, it's funny, right? I mean, it's kind of like when I was a kid, and probably you too as well, you have this version of America and American sports and how they're the biggest, because that's all you know. Like football, like the Super Bowl is the biggest thing ever. And then one day you realize, wait a minute, more people watch the World Cup, right? Soccer. So yes, Lucy was big and MASH was big in our fishbowl, right? But there were a lot of things that were possibly bigger worldwide. I mean, cricket is huge and I can't understand why, but that's me, right? If I knew cricket and I grew up with cricket, I would understand implicitly. So Mr. Beast and a bunch of folks like him are huge. They're huge worldwide. They probably have more. You see numbers for guys like Cristiano Ronaldo, and they have these vanity numbers, just subscribers and all that on YouTube, but they get no views.
Right.
Right. So they really don't have social media power the way that Mr. Beast does. I mean, if Mr. Beast wants to push something, he can push something. Now, he doesn't have the gear ratio of more niche creators. And I'll give you an example. So going back to PewDiePie, I think at the time when I was at Maker, he had a then unheard of number of subscribers of like 45 million-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we had another early OG creator named Shay Carl, who was actually one of the people behind Maker Studios when it was developed. And he had like
maybe a tenth of that, maybe an eighth of that audience-wise, right? But if you ask both of them to say, hey, we're going to sell widget A or t-shirt B, get your audience to buy, not just in percentage, but in raw volume, number of SKUs sold, Shay Carl, right? Over and over again, because his audience cared. His audience came for him. Whereas most of PewDiePie's audience, they find him in their feed and they kind of subscribe just kind of reactively. And it's not really, it's like that band you loved as a kid and you always love them forever and you're really passionate and you wear their t-shirt as an adult, unironically, versus bands you can't even recall from the same year.
Yeah.
But still, when they come to town, somebody's going to go see them, right?
Right. They're good at getting attention.
Right.
Yeah. And but converting, attention is good for ad impressions.
It's great for YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah. But like that, because that's their business, right? But getting people to take actions and whatnot, you know, you need more of a tie, I think, more of a connection to an audience versus just being able to get attention. A lot of people can get.
So in the book, I refer to it as ritual in return. And it's really about habit. It's really about relationship building, right? So it's really about how often does this person look you up, right? To come see what you've published recently. Because YouTube's not going to do that for you. If you've
but
got
that's the
40...
thing, the platforms don't want that, right? They want everyone feeding content into the slot machine and pulling the handle.
Well, if you've got a YouTube account and you're following 40 or 50 channels, there's a good chance that you should be getting fresh content every day surfaced to you just from those 40 or 50. But you don't get that. No one gets that. And if you've over-indexed in a bunch of news channels and they might be kind of niche, leaning one way or the other, I don't take a side on this, you might see the other side popping up in your feed all the time because let's say Fox News is a big partner and they drive a lot of views. So YouTube, not perniciously, not pushing any agenda other than monetization, they think, hey, you're looking for news. Here's some news, right? And you get it. And then after a while, if you do watch that stuff, it starts to pollute your feed like the five-year-old watching cartoons on your Netflix, right? You're just going to get a bunch of garbage suggested for you. It's just a self-enforcing cycle.
Right. So like that to me, like, and that's why I like the optimization of thumbnails. Like I'm obsessed with the fact that everyone does the same approach to thumbnails. I'm like, it's humiliating.
You know, it's so
honestly,
funny though.
It's humiliating. Like
the fact
that you can be like this massive, like you're talking about being like a massive worldwide star and you have to literally do surprise guy face in every thumbnail because of some algorithmic dynamics, that's not freedom. Like you are not a free person.
maybe I'm wrong. I don't think of Mr. Beast as the guy that has a muse and he's expressing himself. I never thought of him that way, right? I thought of him as a really smart guy who's gaming the system and really nakedly ambitious in an admirable way to a certain degree. The same way I admire Jeff Bezos, I guess, to a certain degree. I wouldn't want to be him, but I get it. And right. But so there is that to it. But look, I mean, remember the 90s?
I do.
Well, you get a lot of movie trailers.
I mean, not all of them, but like...
I know, but you
some years are a little fuzzier than
others. There'd be so many trailers where start out with, in a world, right?
Yeah.
All the time. And there's one guy here in LA that was getting driven around from recording studio with a chauffeur. Literally, there's a book about this guy. And he had made bank because everybody wanted their movie to have his voiceover. Because that was like somehow... That was the thumbnail of their day. So it's
and now
the same
he's just,
game.
And now he
I don't think he's
like
alive anymore.
Dreamforce. He just does Dreamforce. And that's the only gig he's got.
You know, but you know what I'm saying? So it like, so, and then like there was a time like in the early 2000s where like you have these commercials on radio, like, monster, monster, monster. Like you like with a reverberation, you know? So everybody finds something that works. And they have the other 90 people that have no imagination or they just want to succeed. They'll do anything. They just copy the person who broke the ground. And that's what happened on YouTube. But it happens on YouTube at such scale. You know what I mean? Next thing you know, if you like Dude Perfect, you can find 15 other people that kind of do this trick shot stuff, right? If you like Mr. Beast, you can find people like, if you like Preston Plays, you can find people like him. There's there's verticals, there's genres. It happened before in radio. It happened in television. It just happens at such more obvious scale on YouTube that it's so much harder to ignore.
What kind of risk factors does YouTube have? I mean, it's ubiquitous, right? Mm-hmm. Like, does it have any risk of, I mean, simply becoming uncool to young people?
I think it's already there. right? It's already rubbing up against that risk. My son,
like Facebook, Facebook quickly became uncool.
It's hard for me to remember that far back. I stopped thinking about Facebook before the first Trump presidency.
MySpace became uncool.
Before the first Trump presidency. That's not correlated. But it became a place where I'd see people. It's kind of like LinkedIn now, where I see people that are supposed to be my connections, but I don't really know them.
So LinkedIn is still cool.
Okay. Well, there you go. But maybe. I don't know. I love LinkedIn. But so YouTube is already up against that. And that is a natural problem that any thing that gets super successful gets. So if you are an early fan of any band, whether it's the Ramones or whatever, right? And you're early, especially when you're young and idealistic, and you're part of the group that gets it, and now all of a sudden all the great unwashed likes it, it's hard to accept that. They're either sellouts or whatever. So, and YouTube is in that phase now where they're putting up a lot of content and it's a very wide audience. So it doesn't surprise me that my son finds the comments section to be pointless or sterile, which drives him to spend his time on TikTok. And short form is the hyper short form is what he likes to consume. He's a soccer head, but he hasn't watched a 90-minute game all the way through in how long? I can't remember when. But he watches all the highlights. And the same for, and all these sports leagues have this problem with the younger generation, right? They're consuming a lot of highlights. They're not consuming a lot of full game viewing.
Right.
That's why the NFL's average age audience member is like 56 or 57 now. It's crazy. So it's hard to monetize clips.
Yeah. That's interesting because like I wonder like how with the shortened attention spans, like that would seem to be working against YouTube. Now I know they have a shorts product, right? But like the essence of YouTube was a longer, quote unquote, longer form. I don't know what the average length of it, but like, you know, so I wonder, you know, if the next generation of creators are going to be either, it's funny, like things either go super long, like an always on stream or it's unbelievably fast.
Yeah. The super longs, like my son used to watch a lot of these when he was early into gaming. He would spend a lot of time on YouTube and he'd watch really long, right? Gameplay. And that was his stage, right? And then after that, he got into shorter stuff and he started watching more of these gamers for their memes and comedy stuff than their actual gameplay. And then he started watching a lot of other video. So my son's progression has been from watching animals pooping on YouTube Kids when he was like little to where he is now, where he's watching, a lot of TikTok, which is qualitatively at times not too different. There's a meme right now where there's a correcting kind of format now where creators or influencers who feel they were the first to do a certain format or a certain thing will seek out another follow-on creator / influencer who's doing the same thing and then correct them on video. And the audience watches it in a weird way, the same way I think like his mother might watch, like, not that my wife does, but that generation would watch Housewives of Atlanta just for the cat fights, right? You just...
Oh, it's like a clapback.
Yeah. Or you're a NASCAR watcher and you're just waiting for the crashes, right? I mean, it's a weird thing, but I see him, I listen, I hear. I'm like constantly auditory monitoring everything he's listening to. It's just for professional purposes, but also just because he's 13. I'm like, what is that? But
yeah.
So that stuff evolves, and no one would go this. There's nobody would say, "Hey, you know what we should do? This is a format we should create and bank on it." Nobody would do that, but it arose on these platforms, and now it's bigger, and who knows where it'll go? I'm waiting for Mr. Beast to do it. That's what I want.
It'll happen. All right, Darren. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for breaking this all down.
My pleasure. Good to see you.